From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour goes back to Lyons, New York, 1951. A young boy named Jimmy loved games, loved sports, but his father had no interest in letting the child win. They played a game of ping pong, and family members might have been surprised to see the father going full throttle, slamming shots and rocketing the ball around the table. Young Jimmy, age 6 or 7, did not score a single point. His father told him bluntly that no one in life would give him anything. He would have to earn it at ping pong, in sports, in school, and in life. Jimmy became Jim Boeheim, an overachieving college basketball player and one of the greatest college coaches of all time. Today, Syracuse fans had hoped his team would still be playing. They are not, eliminated by underdog Dayton last weekend in the NCAA tournament. The man who wrote the book on Boeheim is journalist Scott Pitoniak. Scott joins us for the hour. First of all, Scott, welcome. Nice to see you again. Long time no see.
Long time no see.
Nice to have you. And we're going to talk about Jim Kelly as well in our second half hour. For our listeners, we're going to update you on the latest that we're hearing from doctors on Jim Kelly's condition, talk about his cancer, what we know. Scott has covered Jim Kelly for decades as well, and we're also going to hear from the medical community about that. But for now, we're going to be focusing on the fascinating figure in Western New York that is Jim Boeheim, and a little bit of a surprise that they're out. But let me take it back to 1951, because the anecdote I just shared came from the book Color Him Orange, the Jim Boeheim story that Scott Pitoniak wrote. Scott, his dad didn't believe even in an ounce of letting the child have a thing, did he?
No, he did not. You know, it's interesting, Evan. I had a conversation with Jim one time, and we were talking about this relationship. It was as much a competition. It was more of a competition than a relationship I had with my father. I think it explains a lot of the behavior of James Arthur Boeheim II here, and the way he acts towards people, not always in the most pleasant way and so forth. There was a real telling thing when I was doing interviews with different people from Jim's background that I think really speaks to why he is the way he is. And it was about the father. And when the father was young, he was playing cards with an aunt, and the aunt allowed him to win a game of cards. And when he found out afterwards, he went ballistic.
He thought it was cheap, didn't he?
Yeah. He goes, you're not preparing me for life. This is not the way the world is. And I think that, when I came up, you get those aha moments when you're investigating someone and trying to discover, who they are and why they are the way they are. And that was one of those moments when I was researching this book, when somebody told me that anecdote. And I thought, yeah, that's the whole philosophy that his father had, and that's the way he was going to raise his son.
I think any parent can relate to the fact that you want your kids to be tough. You don't want to beat the heck out of them at every little thing, but you don't want to give them too much. I mean, it's a hard balance. Well, there wasn't much balance. Jim had to earn it. He eventually did, as you say in your book, he eventually beat his father legitimately at all of those sports. And when he would beat his father, they'd stop playing those games, wouldn't they?
Yeah. There's great stories. They were members at the Wayne County Country Club.
Wayne Hills. Yeah.
Wayne Hills. And everyone I spoke to, including Boeheim himself, he corroborated this, like, when the father and the son went out to play, even just supposed to be just a little, fun match and so forth, they never completed 18 holes. I mean, clubs would go flying, they'd be swearing and so forth. And it was just it never ended. And it was kind of sad, because I don't think that obviously if different generation and so forth. I don't know if his father ever said to him, "I love you." And, I remember talking to one of Jim's boyhood friends, and this was early on when, after Jim had been named head coach of Syracuse University's basketball team back in 1976, and they're driving to one of Jimmy's games from Lyons, and this Tony Santilli asks his dad, are you proud of him? And he goes, "Oh yeah, I'm proud of him," and so forth. But he never articulated
that. Friend.
Yeah, never articulated it to Jim.
Yeah.
So there's a certain sadness there. And of course, we know from men of that generation, it was a different way. I mean, a lot of them didn't say to their kids, "I love you," especially to a father to a son. It was just, not thought to be the proper thing to do.
And this is pertinent now because early in the next season, Jim Boeheim will be 70. He looks to me like a young and spry 70, and the question is what's going to be his future. We're going to get to that in a moment, and we'd love to hear from our listeners, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. But before then, You know, you mentioned Tony Santelli, and there's a quote in the book where he says, he was never a good loser. He was always a bad loser, even as a kid, and it never changed.
No, it never changed, and we see that now. I mean, we've seen that even the course of games this season, and even that last loss to Dayton, and in the post game press conference.
Well, that's where I'm going with this, yeah. Scott, because your book helps me understand that. It doesn't necessarily absolve it. So what I want to do here is I want to do a little compare and contrast.
Okay.
The day before. About 48 hours before Syracuse got knocked out, one of Boeheim's friends and contemporaries, Mike Krzyzewski's Duke team, got knocked out, got upset by Mercer in the first round. And Mercer, you know, unheralded team, what does Mike Krzyzewski do? Well, there was a photo that went viral. Krzyzewski went down to the Mercer locker room, showed up there, talked to the coach, and turned to the players and said, if we were going to go out, I'm glad we got beat by a hell of a team. What a great moment. What a classy thing to do in a hard moment. No coach wants to go out, especially when you think you get a chance to be a Final Four contender. Contrast that to the Syracuse Orange goes down to Dayton 55-53 in the second round. And tough loss. Again, no coach is going to like that. But here, let's listen if we could. This is the news conference after the game. Now, my former colleague at 13 WHAM News, Mike Catalana, is the voice you're going to hear first. He's asking Jim Boeheim a question about giving credit to the other team. Let's listen.
There's going to be a lot of focus, so maybe on what your team did not do. But can you talk about Dayton beating Ohio State down the stretch, beating you guys down the stretch? Talk about what they did so well in these last couple of games.
Well, I'm not going to talk about Dayton. Why would I do that? I'm going to talk about Syracuse. I'm not going to talk about Dayton. Ask their coach. He should be very proud of their team.
Okay, Scott. A little bit of a difference than Coach K.
Yeah, without question. I mean, that's Jim is not normally a good loser. I mean, and he hasn't changed. You know, you would think at a certain point. He has mellowed in a lot of ways, but there's still this competitive fire that burns in him, and so it's still Jim Boeheim, age 69, is not that much different than, you know, Jim Boeheim, you know, 38 years ago when he was, you know, first a head coach. He's still very intense, and some people like that. I don't particularly care for it, but you know, we're not going to change him, I guess, at this point.
This point, you're not. And but what's fascinating is here's a guy who grew up, again, Lyons, small town, an introvert, sort of, as you write, a tall, gangly kid who loves sports and kind of overcame some of his awkwardness to become a very successful athlete. And maybe growing up, you've got a dad who whooped you. And I don't mean physically. I mean a dad who just made you earn it, and you never really heard "I love you." And maybe you grow up, and that's your way. But even over time, the only thing that in your book that I saw softening him at all is his wife.
Right.
And thank goodness for that, huh?
Yeah, Julie. And it's interesting, Evan, in that Jim's mom, a lot of people that I spoke to said had kind of a similar effect on the old man. You know, and years later, like his second marriage with Julie, there's a softening. And I also think, too, having younger kids, having kids, you know, late in life, softened him a little bit as well. But yet, he still just seems to be this fiery, intense guy when the game is on. And I guess in one way you can say, like, he still really, really loves and cares about what he's doing. But you still would like to see him temper that a little bit, you know, the way he behaves in adverse situations.
We're talking to Scott Pitoniak, a journalist and author who's covered Jim Boeheim, Jim Kelly over the years. And it's 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We're going to be getting to Jim Kelly in the second half hour. And I see the phones lighting up now. Join the conversation because we want to know what Scott thinks about what's coming for Syracuse. They're in the transition this year was ACC. It was fun to see them have two games against Duke. I'm sure Jim would tell you, even if he's not a warm and fuzzy guy, that meant a lot to him to have a chance to have a home-and-home with Mike Krzyzewski. And those were two of the best games of the year. One of them ended in an amazing classic Boeheim fashion. but, you know, he's going to be 70. And what do we expect for the future of Syracuse with Jim Boeheim?
You know, Evan, as I said, like, he still seems to be very intense and very much into it and very passionate about it. I just think he continues to coach. You know, it's in the news now, like the head coach in waiting at Syracuse forever has been Mike Hopkins. And now there are two openings, I think, at Boston College and Marquette. And Hopkins' name is coming up again. So you wonder, like, how long do I want to be the head coach in waiting? Am I ever going to get a chance? Because the way things are going with, I look at it this way. He's probably guaranteed to coach at least through 2016. And I say that because he and Krzyzewski, his good friend, again, will be coaching the United States Olympic basketball team that will be competing in Rio de Janeiro. And so I can see them going on, both of them, at least, you know, unless there's some major health issue or whatever, through that time. And he's continuing to recruit blue chippers. It's, you know, even if Tyler Ennis and Jeremy Grant yep. leave early for the NBA draft, you know, it's not like the cupboard's going to be bare. I'm not saying they're going to be getting off to a 25-0 start like they did this year or next year, but there's a lot of talent still there. So I really think he wants, you know, I think he wants, he won't tell you this, but I think he really wants to make another run in a national championship and get one more. Because there's still some people who are criticizing him, and I think it's absurd, saying, well, he's only won one national championship. And well, you know, how many coaches have won national championships?
Exactly,
I mean, you know, there's a tendency. I think one of the problems, too, Evan, that I see is that people get spoiled. And, you know, a lot of people want him to step down. You know, oh, they lost again to a double-digit seeded team in the NCAAs and this and that. And, you know, I'm just saying, like, don't, you know, be careful what you wish for, because there's no guarantee that, and I like Mike Hopkins a lot, or whoever is going to succeed Jim Boeheim, that it's just going to continue on.
Yeah. And you know who also lost to double-digit seeded teams? Mike Krzyzewski and Thad Mata and a lot of guys this year.
Yeah.
Let's get to the phones, and there's a lot of comments coming in about sportsmanship and whatnot. I understand all sides of this conversation. Joni and Irondequoit, thanks for calling Connections.
Yes, I have a couple of comments. One has to do with the fact that when Boeheim was asked by Michael Fay who he would like in his foxhole, he said Jerry McNamara. And I wondered if Mike Hopkins at that point had started thinking about moving on, possibly.
That's a very, very interesting question. Yeah. I thought about last year, too. If you remember, Mike Hopkins was up for a job, and I think it was the USC job, University of Southern California.
Uh-huh.
And some of the public comments that Jim made about Mike, I thought were not gracious. You know, like I would have, you know, the way you should have approached it is like, you know, Mike has done a tremendous job for me.
Right.
I would hate in the worst way to see him go. I wish he would stay because I would like to see him succeed me. But, you know, I also understand if there's an opportunity there and he feels it's right, he should go. Plus,
uh-huh.
he's from Southern California. He didn't make that response, you know.
No.
And I kind of felt, and Mike Hopkins is too classy a guy to say so publicly, that I noticed, you know, my antenna went up right away when I heard those comments. I go, wow. You know, like, I mean, come on. This kid has been a loyal lieutenant for you, was a
yes.
great hustling player for you, gave it his all, and has been a great recruiter and a big part of your success in recent years.
Maybe he should have said, I would like Mike and Jerry in my foxhole.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm surprised. Why didn't he say his wife or whatever? You know, I mean, I don't know. But
could I ask another question?
Sure, go ahead.
Charles Barkley said if they had played man-to-man, sometimes they would have gotten layups on the fast break. And wouldn't that have meant that Ennis could have gone in under and on a fast break more if they had played man-to-man?
Yeah, I mean, I see the pros and cons of playing a zone. It's a difficult defense, and it's not a lazy man's defense the way they play it. They do trap and force some turnovers. I think Charles Barkley, sometimes Charles says a lot of
strange things.
Yeah, you know, thought-provoking, let's say.
Well,
things.
There you go. Joni, great X and O's question, too, by the way. Thanks for calling Connection Day. We appreciate that. Let's get Kate in Brighton. Kate, thanks for calling.
Hi. I was wondering if Scott knew at what point in his life Jim came to sports himself as a player. I know when my kids came up through all the different sports they played in grade school and high school, the coaches always emphasized sportsmanship. I mean, was as much a part of the sport as learning the game itself. And clearly Jim did not embrace that if he did learn it as a youngster. And I wondered if he thinks that, in fact, his father's influence was just so much stronger than that, or did he come to sports late where that kind of thing might not have been emphasized as much?
No, it's a great question, and I think you answered it when you asked about the father. I think the father's influence, overruled everything else. Jim did play, he played a number of sports growing up, and his high school coach, Dick Blackwell, was a very innovative coach, very much ahead of his time in terms of the strategy and that they used and scouting reports. And on, we're talking the 1950s and early 60s. And I know that Dick Blackwell was extremely well-respected for sportsmanship. He was very gracious after one of the worst defeats still in Jim Boeheim's life, he will tell you, is, you know, losing to East Rochester here at the old War Memorial. In a double overtime game and stuff, and Dick Blackwell was very, very gracious after that.
Thanks for the call, Kate. And you know, this is what I really enjoy. There's so much I enjoy about Scott's book. Again, it's called Color Him Orange: The Jim Boeheim Story. Easy to find it online. Beautifully done, because you know, if you like sports, great. It's a great sports book, but it's also about people. And Scott does such a great job of penetrating into the lives of and trying to understand why is someone the way they are. So, Scott, I don't absolve Jim Boeheim. When he had that curt response at the news conference dismissing Dayton, you know, I look at him as a guy who was a sore loser in his teens, and he's a sore loser approaching 70, and that's too bad. And I don't absolve him of that, but I read your book, and at least I get it. Mm-hmm. I see it more now. And I know that's kind of what you are after, even though Jim himself put up a little bit of a defense when you were writing the book.
Yeah. You know, and I totally agree with you. I don't absolve him. And, you know, people were saying like, oh, you're going to write this book like, you know, that guy's an idiot and blah, 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 and all that stuff. And I said, you know, I'm just fascinated. I want to know why he isn't happier and why he acts this way, because he has so much to be grateful for in his life. There's no question. But yeah, I wanted this to be a collaboration. I wanted Jim to do, his memoir, his autobiography, and I would be the, you know, in the old fashioned term, the ghostwriter, the Sherpa leading him through this. Mm-hmm. And he didn't want anything to do with that. You know, by that time I had developed a better relationship with him. I mean, I've known him since I was a student at Syracuse, when he was this nondescript assistant coach with huge glasses and these god-awful plaid jackets of the 70s that we were all victims of.
Which, thank goodness, your book has a picture of in there that preserves it for evidence for all time.
Yeah, sartorial clashing going on there with the plaid pants and the plaid. But he can, nah, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. And, so finally my editors in Chicago said, look, it, you know, you've covered and chronicled him, you know, for his entire head coaching career. And we think this guy is worthy of a book. You know, this was coming a few years after the national championship and so forth. So we're going to go ahead and do it if you feel comfortable. And I said, yeah, I know enough about him. And I told Jim that we were going to do that, giving him that last option to, of course, when you do an autobiography or a memoir, you control your story.
Exactly.
When I do it as a detached observer, I control the story to a certain extent, you know. And so he was very, very perturbed, angry at me on the phone. And I go, uh-oh, I go. And I just figured, Evan, at that point, he's not going to talk to me about the book anymore.
Because let's be clear here. Unauthorized biographies happen all the time. And often they don't get any support from the subject of the biography. And yet here's what I think is a testament to Scott and his work here. Even though Jim Boeheim might have cursed you out on the phone, said he didn't want to technically participate, what he could have done was tell everybody in his circle, don't talk to this guy. Mm-hmm. He could have stopped talking to you himself. He didn't do any of that.
No, he didn't. We went to media day that they have like at the start of practice in mid-October, usually it is every team. And you have your PAC journalism thing goes on, and then you break off in individuals. And so when we broke off, you know, I'm talking to him by myself, and I'm asking him questions that are pointed about, you know, specific things of him growing up in Lyons and this and that. And he's answering them.
He knows what you're after.
Right. But, you know, this is also consistent, Evan, with Jim Boeheim. He will, and I've had this happen to me many years of covering him. Like, believe me, I felt his ire and his wrath. And he'll blow up at you, and then 2 days later, you know, he will, you know, he'll be very accommodating. And it's just this complexity of this man. It baffles you at times. And I always knew, like, you know, like Mike asking that question after a game, I always felt the worst time to interview Jim is after a game. It doesn't matter if they won by 40 or, you know, if they lost at the buzzer. you know, you're running the risk that he's going to lay into you, you know?
Yeah, very interesting. And by the way, the best endorsement of the book, and a sign that Jim Boeheim, despite his reluctance for Scott to do this book, has the utmost respect for Scott Pitoniak, is the fact that Scott has since found out that fans will bring him the book, Color Him Orange, asking him to sign it. And a lot of times you'll hear stories of athletes or entertainers who had unauthorized biographies. They're not going to sign it. They reject it.
Yeah.
What has Jim done?
Yeah, he has signed the book. I've heard this from a number of fans, and he's, you know, he we've never really totally discussed the book afterwards, you know. There was a radio sports prominent radio sports host in Syracuse who asked him about it at the end of what I'm going, oh my gosh, like, you've got guts to do that. And Jim was fairly complimentary. He said something to the effect of, yeah, I respect him as a journalist. He goes, he got most of it right. You know, so then that's like getting like the, you know, the good housekeeping
sure.
seal of approval for Jim, you know.
Well, let's get to the phones real briefly here again as we wrap our conversation on Jim Boeheim. Here's Maggie. Thanks for calling, Maggie.
Hi. This is in the nature of gossip, really, but it does go to the competitive nature of Mr. Boeheim. I have a cousin who lives up near Syracuse, and he's a big Syracuse fan, and somehow he got to be buddies with Jim. And Jim would come to his house for dinner, and, I mean, they had a social thing going, and the rest of us are going, wow, gee. Well, all of a sudden, the whole thing ended, and found out later because Jim made a pass at my cousin's wife.
Oh, see, I don't want to get into this here. Maggie, I appreciate that, but that's I can't go in that direction here. Look, that's, and as she said, at least Maggie was nice enough to say it's in the realm of hearsay. But no need to go in that direction, Maggie. Let's at least wrap with this, Scott. We heard the news Tuesday, 2 days ago, that Jim Boeheim is now going to put out his own autobiography. He'll have a writer with him doing it. And, you know, as someone who respects your work, I was disappointed because I feel like the story has been written. We're going to see it. But at least at this point, I feel, you know, maybe he does feel like there's more to say, or his career is not over. A lot of people thought a few years ago he'd be retiring, and it's not.
Yeah. You know, I'll be interested. Jack McCallum from Sports Illustrated, very, very good writer, is the guy doing it. And I'm sure it's going to be a very good book. What I would be really intrigued to know is if he was, you know, willing to talk in depth about that relationship with his father. I mean, and I don't know, you know, how introspective Jim's going to be or how forthcoming on some of that stuff. You know, and how honest that's the danger. Like when I was going to, if he was going to collaborate with me, well, then he's going to control the story, as I said. And you wonder, is it totally an honest picture of the person? You know, we have difficulty, all of us, being objective about ourselves. The big thing is going to be, of course, how forthcoming and honest is he going to be about the Bernie Fine situation and the sexual molestation allegations against his longtime friend and assistant coach. And, that's a real, obviously a very touchy, difficult area. And he got himself into a lot of trouble with his initial reactions in defense of Bernie Fine, where, you know, defamation of, character lawsuits and so forth. And that was an ugly, sordid time for him. So that, to me, will be interesting to see what comes of that. So again, I think it'll be a good book. I'll read it, but I would like to think that I touched upon some of the major areas.
The book's beautiful. The book is called Color Him Orange, the Jim Boeheim story. Let me wrap the conversation with this, Scott. I know it's been told so many times. You open the book with that story that feels like it must be apocryphal, but apparently it's true, that he is vacationing with Pitino.
Rick Pitino.
And this is why, if you read Scott's book and you get this anecdote, and if you've never heard the story, I can't wait for Scott to tell this story. This is why I think Jim Boeheim, this might be a Pope job. He might just decide, he's never going to retire because he obviously loves basketball. Tell the story.
Yeah, you're talking about the being on the beach in Hawaii, and it's Jim Boeheim and his first wife, and it's Rick Pitino and his wife. And Rick Pitino, I should go back tell you, was an assistant coach under Jim Boeheim briefly.
And there is a delicious picture in the book of Boeheim and Pitino. You've got to see the picture.
Yeah, the 1970s hair. Anyway, they're on the beach, and you know, we all have these couples, we have these conversations. Like, if you could live any place in the world, where would you live? And of course, you know, I mean, I have this conversation with Beth, and we've had it with other couples and stuff. So, you know, the responses are, you know, like Rick Pitino's wife is talking about like Fifth Avenue, New York. I, you know, would love to live in New York City in a real swanky place. I think like Boeheim's wife may have said like Hawaii, like what's better than this place here? And Pitino, someone says Paris. So then we get to Jim, and Jim says Syracuse. And they're all looking at Boeheim saying like, okay, he's been in the sun too much, and he's had too many of these funny drinks with the umbrellas and stuff. The joke is, and this could be a little apocryphal, that they got their blankets and moved a little further away, you know, their towels, and moved a little further up the beach from Jim because he obviously was crazy at that point.
But he explained it by saying that 8 months out of the year, Syracuse is like Hawaii.
Right.
And then the other 4 months, they're doing what?
They're playing basketball.
So who cares?
Yeah. And, you know, and there's something innocent and that I liked about it because there was a realness there. And as much as, you know, we rag on the guy, you know, for his behavior and so forth, one thing I will say, Evan, you know, when we look for like attributes that you admire, he is a loyal person. And, you know, and for him, like, you know, we're all in search of that paradise and that, you know, and a place where the grass is so green and lush. And sometimes that we don't realize that it's right where we are. And so I thought there was a certain simplicity and innocence and something that I really admired about that. And for all his faults, and he has been literally loyal to a fault at times, you cannot deny his loyalty to Syracuse University.
Yeah. Scott Pitoniak, the author of Color and Orange, The Jim Boeheim Story. He's also written extensively on the Buffalo Bills in print, in books, etc. Big news on Jim Kelly. If you're just getting that news this week, we're going to update you on what doctors are saying, the very latest on that, get the medical community's perspective. So let's take a short break, the shortest break in radio, and we'll be right back with Connections on member-supported public radio. And welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. On this Thursday afternoon, Scott Pitoniak is in studio with us, as is Dr. Matt Miller from the University of Rochester Medical Center. We're talking about Jim Kelly, the latest family news being released this week, and his doctors talking about his treatment options for cancer. Dr. Miller, before we get into that specifically, let me just make sure our audience understands your background. Tell us about what you do at URMC.
Sure. So I am an assistant professor of otolaryngology and neurosurgery. So,
and I'll ask you only because I hustled him into the studio real briefly. Get a little closer to the mic.
Sure.
There you go. We're all friends here. So tell us again your background and your practice.
So sure. I'm an assistant professor of otolaryngology and neurosurgery at the University of Rochester. My training is in ear, nose, and throat surgery with specialized training in head and neck cancer and skull-based surgery as well.
Are you a Bills fan?
I'm a huge Bills fan.
So you've been obviously following Jim Kelly, the player. I'm sure you have followed his personal story with interest.
Absolutely.
Okay. And so, I'm not nearly as up to date as a lot of people in the medical community. He had treatment less than a year ago, I think.
Correct.
And so, can we start there? And either Scott or Dr. Miller, do you want to jump in, Dr. Miller, with what we know about where this started with Jim Kelly?
Sure. My understanding, you know, obviously I'm not his treating physician, so I know probably as much as you all know, but my understanding is that he was diagnosed with a tumor involving his upper jaw or the maxilla last September, I believe, and was treated surgically at the time and rendered disease-free by all accounts. And subsequently was found to have recurrent disease more recently, and that's what's been in the news.
And so this week, we had heard some conflicting reports. One of the reports we heard was that today, Thursday, was going to be a day of new surgery, but we learned last night, and Scott, you've been covering the fact that any family with an ongoing health story, there's emotion. Sometimes you hear a family member will tell you something. Sometimes it's optimistic, et cetera. What were we hearing this week, and what can you tell us about what you saw from them last night?
Well, they've decided not to go ahead with the surgery, and that they're going to treat it with chemo and radiation. And I think, you know, it's interesting in this world of social media. We've been kind of updated by the family and Jill Kelly, and just some really heart-rending photos of, you know, Jim's daughters in bed with him in the hospital bed and stuff. And really, I mean, really just tugs at your heart. And she's been kind of keeping us up to date, you know, but this is going to be the new strategy that they're going to, I guess, employ. And she has been fairly candid in saying that, you know, it's spreading aggressively. And, you know, she has used terms like, you know, he's in the battle for his life.
Yeah, and so Dr. Miller is not here again to weigh in on the specifics of Jim Kelly's situation, but he can talk about the fact that when doctors say it's spreading aggressively and that surgery is not a good option right now, my reaction is you want surgery to be the first option, don't you? I mean, that's not good news.
Yeah, it certainly depends on where the tumor is. Tumors of the mouth, tumors of the jaw, typically we do treat them with surgery up front, many times giving radiation and or chemotherapy afterwards. When we hear the term surgery is not the best option, typically that means that these have spread further up towards the skull base. These tumors have a tendency to jump onto nerves and actually extend up towards the skull, up towards the brain. And when that happens, many times from just a functional standpoint, surgery is not a great option because the consequences can be so devastating.
263-WXXI, 263-9994, and you can also jump into the conversation on our social media on Facebook and Twitter if you want to opine or comment on this. A lot of support for Jim Kelly coming in, and I know, Scott, his family has said he's seeing that, isn't he?
Yeah, he really is, and I mean, it's overwhelming. Again, with the world we live in which we live in now with social media, has really like opened up even more opportunities than the old days of just getting a, you know, a letter in the mail and a card or whatever. And I know it means an awful lot. I talked to Jim about, I want to say a month and a half ago for a column I was doing, and this was before the cancer had reoccurred. Mm-hmm. You know, he was in a lot of pain. He has a prosthetic and so forth, but Jim has always been a very, very upbeat guy. And I know from covering him as a football player and stuff, there was, you know, a lot of adverse situations that he faced, and he had a tremendous resiliency, you know, to bounce back from a sack, from an interception, you know, from a loss, and obviously the loss in, you know, end of the season and Super Bowls and so forth. And so hopefully, you know, I mean, that kind of resiliency will help him as much as possible, you know, in this struggle.
Can we talk a little bit? You mentioned the prosthetic. That's a common eventuality, Dr. Miller?
Yeah, it's very common. Certainly we can do reconstructive surgery to rebuild the jaw, but many times from a standpoint of cosmetics, being able to have teeth, you know, we talk about a prosthetic, but it's more of an enhanced denture in these circumstances. It kind of fits into the cavity that's left by the surgical resection. You know, you probably walk by people every day that have had these and can't even tell. So it's a very, very good option for rehabilitation.
Scott, how often have you had a chance to talk to Jim over the years since he retired?
Oh, quite a bit. I've written a number of columns, you know, both when I was at the Democrat and Chronicle and then since with the Rochester Business Journal and other, you know, publications I've written for. So, I run into Jim from time to time and, you know, again, he's always been a very optimistic, resilient, you know, let's move forward type of guy who's, you know, he's obviously been dealt with a lot of stuff to deal with, a lot of very difficult stuff, prominent being, you know, the death of his son, Hunter, and you know, what he had to do with Krabbe's disease and what they dealt with, you know, for 8 years. And now, of course, with the health problems, you know, he's facing, you know, a really difficult situation again.
It's a hard question for Dr. Miller because, again, Dr. Miller is not here to weigh in specifically on the Jim Kelly case, but to speak generally about, you know, treatment options and what can happen. Mark on Twitter says, if they got the cancer out last year, why is it back? You know, again, that's an individual case. You're not going to know specifically, but can you address that kind of a question?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. It's certainly a question we get all the time. Unfortunately, these cancers do have a very real recurrence rate, even when they're at their early stages. I think, you know, in this area in particular, the things we look at is as I mentioned before, when the tumor can jump onto nerves, they can be very insidious and can hide and eventually come back. Certainly in someone who has risk factors, many times it's actually a second tumor that's grown if they have a disease elsewhere that was previously undetected.
And Christine on Twitter wants to know, if we know what causes cancer in other parts of the body, what causes cancer in the jaw?
Sure. So the type of cancer, at least that's been reported for Jim Kelly, is a squamous cancer. And the most common cause we see is actually tobacco use. Jim Kelly, you know, admittedly is not a tobacco user. And certainly there are other causes. We see things like the HPV virus, which causes a lot of the tumors in the mouth and throat. We see things like chronic immune system suppression, so people who have other chronic immune diseases. And many times, unfortunately, it's just bad luck, and we don't come up with a cause.
Is that generally the case that we understand here? Scott, I know you've talked to Jim.
Yeah, he never specified, you know, what the cause was or whatever. But I will confirm that he was not a smoker. You know, there was a funny line when he was back as a bachelor, a quarterback for the Bills and stuff, that he hated to date women who smoked because he said, and this was Jim's words, it was like kissing an ashtray. So I know he did not smoke. And as best I know, despite being a hunter and fitting, you know, this rugged, you know, man stereotype, I don't believe he, you know, he used chewing tobacco as well.
263-WXXI, 263-9994. Dr. Miller, how common does this kind of cancer rank in terms of the cancers that we see? How often do you see it?
So, you know, in my practice, it's just about all that I see. But worldwide, this only accounts for about 2% of all cancers worldwide, so quite rare. And certainly, if you kind of parse it down to the exact area in the mouth where he got it, it's even more rare. So very, very rare tumor, and again, for it to be in someone who's a non-tobacco user without other risk factors, it's extraordinarily rare.
I was telling Scott before the show started today that a lot of varied headlines about the news in the last 24 hours that doctors decided not to perform surgery, with Jill Kelly saying that that it is an aggressive form of cancer and it's spread. The most optimistic I saw was in the New York Daily News this morning, and the headline is, Jim Kelly avoids cancer surgery. Doctors say it is treatable and potentially curable. So you don't give up hope. I mean, certainly not, Dr. Miller. That headline sounds very optimistic to me.
No, it is, and I think, you know, there's obviously got to be some truth in it if that's what they're saying. Again, it all depends on where this tumor is spread. You know, many times we have to treat patients up front with surgery and radiation and chemotherapy. And so, you know, perhaps he's in a situation where he's had the first component of treatment, which was a surgery, and now to essentially finish the job, for lack of a better term, he needs to have the adjuvant chemotherapy and radiation therapy.
Let me read what Jill Kelly, his wife, did put out yesterday. Surgery turned out not to be the best option for Jim, Jill Kelly wrote in a Facebook update. Doctors told us that the oral cancer, which was diagnosed last summer and recently returned, is in areas that surgery cannot successfully eradicate. She went on to write that the new plan is for her husband, a 54-year-old former NFL quarterback, to be treated with chemo and radiation in Manhattan. And if you didn't see it, there's been multiple emotional images. But Scott, the picture of him hugging his dad, if you missed that, that was a powerful one, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they've always had a special, very strong relationship, he and his father. I remember during the Super Bowl years actually going down with a photographer, and we did a story in East Brady, Pennsylvania, this small western Pennsylvania coal town where Jim's from, and you know, went to Jim's house, and you know, I've noticed that relationship through the years of him with his father meant everything in the world to him. So This is, yeah, there's been just, I mean, a lot of photos that have been posted that really bring tears to your eyes.
You first started writing about Jim when, Scott?
Well, when he first showed up. The first day back, it was like a coronation, really, when he showed up in Buffalo, because he was the football savior, was finally coming after the USFL had folded, thereby freeing his contract back to the Bills. He showed up in mid-August of 1986, and the press conference in a ballroom of a hotel in downtown Buffalo was attended. It was packed. There had to be over 1,000 people there, and there was calls from the governor. It was just the most incredible thing you saw. And you know, the Bills sold something like 10,000 season tickets within a matter of a couple of weeks. It just had that impact. And you just, you know, after so many down years and a drought, here's this guy, you know, with his star power and coming to town. And it was really an incredibly exciting time.
I'm trying to remember. There was obviously the four Super Bowls. And I grew up a Browns fan with most of my family in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when the Browns played Buffalo and Ronnie Harmon dropped the ball in the corner of the end zone. I don't know, Dr. Miller, I don't know if you remember that one, too. You remember it well? I was, as a fan in Cleveland, I had the picture of Ronnie Harmon in the Sports Illustrated just out of reach up on my wall. Was that the year, Scott, before they made their Super Bowl run of four in a row?
Yeah.
I mean, it could have been five Super Bowls.
Yeah, that was it's funny you bring that up, because a bunch of us reporters had gone down, you know, before the end of the game, and we were literally standing in the back line of the end zone. And you could see how Ronnie Harmon didn't know where he was on the field. He had lost track. Because he thought he was like right near the end line.
So he had to sort of short arm it.
So he short armed it, yeah. And he could have just, if he had continued in stride, he would have caught it easily. But yeah, what that game was, that was the birth of the no huddle offense. And that's when, you know, because the Browns had gotten way up and the Bills had no choice but to run the hurry up. And that was the birth of it. After that, Ted Marchibroda, the coordinator, and Marv Levy got together in the offseason and said, "Boy, Jim really runs that well. Why don't we try something different?" And that was a revolutionary thing. You know, now it's commonplace to see teams operate at really quick speeds in their offense. But, you know, it goes back to that game and that time. And that's where that was born. And that, you know, contributed to, obviously, that's when things took off for the Bills to go to the Super Bowl.
You know, so as a Browns fan for me, I think that was at the 89 season, early 90 maybe?
Yeah.
And that was the Browns, of course, went on to lose once again to Denver the next week. So it wasn't a guarantee that the Bills would have been in five straight Super Bowls. But what a career Jim Kelly had. And now, what I'm curious to know, Scott, is when you met him in August of 1986, compare the Jim Kelly you met and reported on then to the Jim Kelly that you know today, even before the cancer?
Well, he was a very cocky, you know, kid back then. He really was. And he had a, you know, he had a real swagger about him and, you know, could be difficult to deal with. He was immature at the time, not only in dealing with reporters, but just dealing with his own teammates. And, you know, we talk about that 1989 season was the season, quote unquote, of the bickering Bills. There was a lot of infighting going on. To the Kelly, you know, through the years, I've seen him grow and mature. He clearly has been humbled a lot and, you know, and has faced such tremendous adversity. I mean, as a parent, I can't begin to fathom what he and Jill went through when Hunter's diagnosis and, you know, what they lived through for 8 years and watching, you know, their child suffer. And I remember writing a column talking to Jim about Father's Day and how, you know, I always had this dream of having a son, and you know, I always dreamed of playing catch with him and going fishing and doing all these things, and you know, I was never able to do that. But he learned, you know, he was inspired by his son. So I think, you know, all these things were, it happens to all of us. We get older. Hopefully, we become more mature, but we're also shaped by, you know, circumstances, yeah. And he clearly has been.
On Twitter, Rachel says, and again, every time I go to Dr. Miller, I have to specify that Dr. Miller is not a personal attending physician to Jim Kelly. So, but Rachel says, love the Bills, love the Kellys. Can the doctor tell us what the real best case scenario is?
Sure. I think the real best case scenario is that he would have a complete response to the chemotherapy and radiation therapy.
How often does that happen?
You know, it really depends. You know, it depends on where the tumor is, how far it's spread. But it is certainly plausible. You know, tumors in this area, if we just look at cure rates, for tumors that are advanced stage, probably 60% of the time we can get a complete response. Now, whether or not that response is durable is another question, and sometimes that's really just the...
Can you define complete response?
Complete response meaning the tumor radiographically, meaning on x-rays, or clinically on physical examination disappears.
And you can get that maybe 60% of the time?
It, depending on the circumstances, yeah.
Okay. So that is not out of the realm of rational plausibility here. That's not
correct.
A pie in the sky, one in a million.
Correct.
It's possible.
Correct.
You know, I guess we're going to have to wait and see. Do we know how long until we get a better idea for him?
Yeah, so typically what we'll do is someone will get 6 to 7 weeks of radiation and chemotherapy, depending on the regimen that they get. And then we'll have some imaging at some point within the first 2 to 3 months afterwards to evaluate the responsiveness to the tumor. They can have some sort of an idea ongoing as well. During radiation therapy, many times they'll get another CAT scan or an MRI just to evaluate the tumor response. It may alter the way that they're doing the treatments. And, you know, we can't forget also that even if there is not a complete response to the radiation and chemotherapy, surgery may be an option if the tumor's shrinks down significantly.
Rachel on Twitter, I hope that that helps give you an idea here. So there's a lot we're going to learn. There's a lot we still don't know. But let me begin to wrap the conversation this hour by asking Scott, you know, ever since Jim retired, his name would come up for people would say he's going to run for Congress, or people going to say that, you know, we talked yesterday about the fact that Ralph Wilson passed away this week, and there was talk that Jim Kelly could help lead a group. I mean, former athletes are popular when it comes to this idea of sweeping in to save a team. Was he ever seriously involved in any Bill's efforts to help the team's future here?
Yeah, I talked to him, off the record, and he was involved with a group in Canada. And he was very. He goes, oh, I can't give you all the particulars. All I want, you know, you to know and Bills fans to know is that everything's going to be okay. The team's going to stay here. He had to be very careful because he was obviously he really loved Ralph Wilson and didn't, you know,
very loyal to Ralph
and didn't want it to look like, you know, here I am. I'm talking about someone's death before their death. He was very respectful of Ralph, and so you know he. He was going to be the front man. Obviously, he doesn't have the money, to be an owner. But he was going to be a front man, not unlike John Elway was, you know, with the Broncos and so forth. He wasn't the real money behind the ownership and so forth, but he was the face. That obviously a lot of people have been talking about that. It's interesting. It's a lot of people have been talking about that. Lately, obviously, with Ralph's death and now given Jim's health, you know, what is going to transpire there?
Tough week for Bills fans. Let's wrap up with this. My favorite Jim Kelly memory was the incomplete pass to Ronnie Harmon in the corner of the end zone, followed by the interception by Clay Matthews. Bills fans, I'm mostly kidding. just 10 seconds here. Scott, your favorite Jim Kelly memory.
Oh, wow. How can I pick one? I'll say this, the most poignant one, his speech. His acceptance speech at the induction into the Pro Football Hall of Fame, Hunter Kelly was down there,
yeah,
and him giving him the nod at the end was just real. I mean, it brought tears to my eyes.
Yeah, Dr. Miller, you're a Bills fan.
Yeah, personally meeting him as a kid, both Jim Kelly and Bruce Smith in person, just larger than life to me growing up here in Western New York, and just a fantastic guy, and wish him well.
I will amend my favorite Jim Kelly memory. I met him many times when he would come to Rochester for these events, and he was so strong and so positive and such an inspiration in helping with the cause with his son, knowing that the outcome, something was coming eventually, but Jim was so strong. And we hope that he can stay strong now. Scott Pitoniak, thank you for the hour. Great talking to you on these subjects. Dr. Miller, thanks for being here, and thanks for sharing your expertise.
Thanks.
Connections continues the next hour. Stay with us.